Welcome everyone who's here this morning, and I'll join with Ed and particularly welcome the visitors, both those that are back with us after a long time, and also those of you that might be from this area and this community visiting with us. I hope that you'll find your time here profitable, and you'll want to come back and be with us again in the future. And if there's anything that in particular that you have questions about, feel free to ask. You can certainly ask me or one of the members here, and we'll be glad to talk with you about anything of your concern. I was away last Sunday morning and really enjoyed being at Piscataway, worshiping with those brethren, getting to know Gary Eubanks, whom we support from here, and Jerry Falk, who both of whom preached there. Of course, Jerry working with more with the Spanish brethren. But enjoyed being with them and appreciate the opportunity to be there. But also understand Roger did an excellent job filling in for Edward, who was filling in for me. But I heard that he did a really good job, and so I'm glad certainly of that. You may be looking at the title up here on the board and think that that's an ironic title, or maybe ironic may not be the best word. Maybe that's just not something that can be reprehensible Christianity. If you notice the questions this morning, they were a wide range of questions about different things. The first of which I ask you, and as you're thinking about the title, what might you find about Christianity that would be reprehensible? Reprehensible means something that is culpable. It means something that is deserving of blame or condemnation or reproach or even censure. Now, what in the world about Christianity would we find to blame, to condemn? What would we say is in Christianity is full of reproach? What would we be willing to censure? That is, have nothing to do with in Christianity? You might be saying, well, nothing. I mean, Christianity would be a system that of which there is no blame, because it is a system that is built on, around, and totally, completely having to do with Jesus Christ. And there would be nothing that is culpable about Jesus. And you'd be right. I'd agree with you. But as we get into the lesson, you'll understand exactly what I mean by that, so let's do that. Reprehensible Christianity. I want to start by noting a debate, and this lesson grows out of this debate that I was reading. I take a publication called Reason and Revelation. Some of you may be familiar with that. If you're not familiar with the publication, you might be familiar with the Apologetics Press. And if you've ever had dealings with atheists or evolution or something like that, chances are great, if you did any kind of search and you were looking for material by brethren having to do with those type of subjects, you ran into Apologetics Press. Kyle Butt is a member of the church who's an associate editor of Reason and Revelation. Very intelligent man. And I would recommend that material and that site to you, especially on those subjects. But he had a debate with a couple of young atheists, and in that discussion, they charged, it was about Christianity versus atheism, and they charged that Christianity, and you'll notice I have that in quotation marks, they charged that Christianity is in fact reprehensible. And so I got to thinking about it. I won't say everything that was in the debate, and I will take off on that. But I really got to thinking about their charge. And they said Christianity was reprehensible. And they based that on a number of observations, one of which I'm going to single out, and a couple of others that I'm going to add to it. But their main point of argument, and first of all, let me notice that Brother Butt acknowledged the truth of a lot of their charges. When they were saying that it was reprehensible, he said many times in the debate, well, you're right. What you're saying is true. What you're saying is right. Now, if they were charging Christianity to be full of blame, so to speak, reprehensible, then why in the world would he say they were right? And I'll try to explain that, and I think it will become self-evident in just a moment. I think it's also helpful to note what these atheists were finding so reprehensible about Christianity. And any time you pick up a discussion like this, at least that I do, When I read a discussion, I'm not just simply looking at what they say, and I'm not trying to approach it from the standpoint of, they're an atheist, or, you know, so-and-so's an atheist, I'm not. For one thing, I try to approach it from the standpoint that really where they are is where I was at one point. Now, I wavered quite a bit, and never got maybe as deeply, but for a while, I was about as antagonistic toward Christianity as anyone around me, and a lot of people in high school can attest to that. But I understand where they're coming from, and so I try to look at that. But I also try to look further and listen to what they're saying and ask myself, indeed, is their charge true? And so we're going to do that. We're going to kind of note a couple of things this morning. In addition, I think it's useful, not just that one debate, but I think it's useful to note biblical misrepresentations. And together with certain so-called Christian beliefs. Really what I'm saying is, you know, I'm a Christian, but what are my beliefs? And would those beliefs and actions that I have in my life, would they be found by skeptics to be flawed and thus reprehensible? In other words, if an atheist were taking a look at my beliefs, at yours, or my actions as a Christian are yours, would they be able to make charges and say, well, what you practice or what you believe is reprehensible? There's blame to be found. There are flaws to be found with it. And would they find those flaws and be able to blame based on what I'm saying or what I'm doing? Now, let's go a little further with that. The atheists in this particular debate found fault with Calvin's system. And that was the thing that they brought up. So if you notice from the very first slide, Bud agreed with them and said, you're right. Well, he's saying you're right because they were finding fault with Calvin's system. Now, very quickly, and this is not going to be a lesson about Calvin or Calvinism, but what is Calvin's system? Really, Calvin's system is more his student, Theodore Bates' system, but that aside, popularly known as Calvinism, it's these 5 points. And let me put them all up there. And you've seen the acrostic probably, the TULIP. You see the T-U-L-I-P. And it's a system supposedly based on the Bible that goes something like this, if I can do it quickly and simply. That man is, because of Adam's sin, and I'm not going to go to the Bible passages that are misrepresented, but let's just simply say it like that. Man is, because of Adam's sin, he is born being totally depraved. He has inherited Adam's sin. Now, that's where Calvin started. And really, if we were to be honest about it, that's where Augustine started in the 4th century. And that's where Calvin got it. But man is born totally depraved. Because of that, then the only way for man to be saved is if God sometime in the distant past, before the world was ever created, if God elected some people to be saved. To put that simply, God looked out in the future and said, of these 5 people, you got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Michael. Okay? And of those 5 people, any given 5, I choose to save Mark. Only Mark. Matthew, Luke, John, and Michael will all be lost. And so when we are finally born, it has already been determined by God that we are saved or lost. Because of that then, when it is decided Jesus will come to the earth and died, if Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Michael, if only one of them, Mark, is going to be saved, then Jesus is only dying for Mark. He's not dying for me because God already determined that I was going to be lost. When I am born, when Mark is born, or when I am born, since it's already been determined, if Mark is to be saved, the grace of God will come on Mark, and irresistibly, he just won't have a choice. He'll have to be saved because God determined it already. When Michael is born, he'll have to be lost because God already determined it. And if Mark is saved, and God already determined that he will be saved, then God will save him no matter what he does. So perseverance of the saints. Once saved, always saved. And by the same token, Michael, once lost, always lost. Now that's the system. It logically follows If you believe the first point, that man has inherited Adam's sin and is totally depraved, therefore cannot respond to God, etc., that would logically follow. It's a logical system, but it's based on a false premise, and it fails at its very first point. Well, these atheists said, and I'm quoting one of them, if God arbitrarily chose some to be saved and some to be lost, regardless of their choices, then God's unjust. And of course, but agreed. But he pointed out that Calvinism is not true Christianity. Reprehensible Christianity would be, whether it's Calvin or me, that believes that somehow I don't have a choice about what I do. Now, a person might say, well, I don't believe the tulip. Well, do you? Do you ever find yourself justifying what you do, the sins you commit, by basically saying to yourself, I can't help it? It's not my choice, really, to be a sinner. I just can't help what I do. Whether you know it or not, you really are falling prey to Calvin's system. You may not think like that. Or do you ever find yourself saying, well, it doesn't matter that I sin, because I'm a Christian, I've been baptized, and God is going to forgive me because I am His child. Whether you know it or not, you really are falling prey to Calvin's system. So while we are very quick to look at something like Calvinism and say, well, man, I don't believe that, sometimes we find emotionally that we do give credence to things like Calvinism, and if we're not careful, we fall to the same thing. And the point being is reprehensible. There is no way in which the Bible teaches, obviously, that because Adam sinned, I inherited the sin from Adam, and I'm so totally depraved I can't respond to God. God doesn't teach that. And so God certainly doesn't teach that He chose to save me or not, way in the distant, and I just don't have any choice about it. And Jesus didn't die for just the one out of five. He died for everybody, and so forth and so on. So they said, God would be unjust, and Brother Bud said, you're right. That's exactly right. It's reprehensible, but it's not true Christianity. Now, I thought it interesting then, and I got to thinking, looking at that debate, and I won't go further with that. They debated Calvinism and all the points of it, and I'm not going to dig into that. But I thought it would be interesting to go beyond that. And let's just ask in a general way, what do atheists find so reprehensible? I mean, they obviously don't believe in Christianity. And when you begin to look at their publications, and I used to take a lot more of them than I do now, but when you look at their publications, they frequently expose these, what I'll call pseudo-Christians, what others will call pseudo-Christian positions. They expose them for what they are. They're reprehensible. Not just Calvinism, but other things. What other things? Well, for one thing, let's back up for a moment. For one thing, theistic evolution. This is something that brethren, in the last 20 years or so, maybe not quite 20, but this has been very popular among brethren. It is something that we almost see, and I look in history, and it's almost like this since 100 years ago, roughly speaking. Evolution has been popular, and it seems like every couple of decades, somebody is coming along and trying to fit evolution, and I mean of brethren, not just the world out there, but among our own brethren, even among those we would call conservative brethren, trying to fit evolution into the Bible. And no matter what you call it theistic evolution, which is just really a term that means I believe in evolution and I believe in God at the same time. It can't be defended. Let me give you a quote from an atheist, for example, and what he says about it. Now, this is David Mills, and you can see the reference there. He wrote a book called Atheist Universe, The Thinking Person's Answer to Christian Fundamentalism. And if you'll read the quote carefully with me, he says, if Earth's history began with creation week, and if Genesis, and you might want to turn to Genesis 1 and look at this, if Genesis provides an accurate historical record, then what does that mean? Well, it means Earth had no prehistoric eras. I mean, really, the oldest time on Earth is recorded for us in Genesis 1, is it not? So there's no prehistoric eras. There are no prehistoric peoples. In other words, all this idea of cavemen, and go back further than cavemen, you know, the apes that kind of stood upright that we see so popularly on National Geographic and all that. None of that's true. Because the Bible would be telling you that the world began with fully modern man. That's what he's saying. No prehistoric eras, no prehistoric peoples, no prehistoric animals. Dinosaurs would have walked the earth only a few thousand years ago, not millions, but just a few thousand years ago. And they would have walked side by side with modern man. And what he's saying is that's how stupid Christians really are. Because if you believe the Bible and you believe the Genesis record, what he's saying, understand, he as an atheist is looking at the Bible the way it really reads, and the way it really reads is that the earth is only a few thousand years old, dinosaurs walked with man, and there is no such thing as prehistoric times. And so he would come away from that saying, that's how stupid you have to believe to believe in the Christianity, or to believe in the Bible that is the book of Christianity. Now let's explore that for a moment. Regarding theistic evolution, truthfully, if the Bible record is correct, then creation, or the creation account, accounts for the earth to have occurred in 6 24-hour days. Now, some of our brethren are saying, well, no, that's not really what Genesis 1 is saying, but look at Genesis 1. If you're open to it, how many times does it say the evening and the morning were the first day? In other words, there's an evening and morning per day. That's why I put it like that. The evening and the morning were the second day. The evening and the morning were the third day. In other words, it's 6 24-hour days. There's a sun. There is the same revolving, if you will, around the sun. The same rotation of the earth is set in motion by God the very first week. And if all of that is set in motion the very first week, and the evening and the morning were the first day, then it's 6 24-hour days. There aren't millions and even billions of years there in Genesis 1. The atheist is right. There are not the billions of years. And so we would say it like this. The earth, according to Genesis, is at least 6,000 years old. I mean, a little over. We could easily account for that. But it's really no older than about 10 to 15,000 years old. Now, I'm not going to get deeply into that discussion this morning, but if you'd like to discuss that with me, I'd be glad to sit down with you and talk about why I would say those two things. Why I would say at least 6,000, but really not much older than 10 to 15,000 years. If you want to say, you mean it can't be 16,000? Well, it might be. But when we start getting much beyond 15,000, no, it's not allowable. It can't be. Now, I say that it can't be because of this, but I would also say it can't be because of the world's record as well. And like I said, I'd be glad to sit down and discuss that with you. Those of you in the Wednesday night class that I had downstairs, you know we spent some time looking at that. And it's a very interesting study. But the bottom line is this. The earth cannot be the 4.6 billion plus. I mean, you listen to this and it wavers. It grows as sometimes as much as 20 billion years now. But at least the classic 4.6 billion for the last 30 years, for which evolutionists contend, it just can't be. And there are many reasons why it cannot be. And again, I'd be glad to sit down with you and talk about that. And those billions of years certainly will not fit in Genesis 1 and in the Genesis account. So when an atheist says, if you believe the Bible, then you really believe the earth is about somewhere between 6 maybe and 10,000 years old, but you really don't believe billions of years, I would say, you're really right, I don't. That's exactly what the Bible is saying. And then there would be reasons why, but you're right in making that charge. Now to come back and say to me then, to try to believe in evolution, to try to believe in those billions of years, and say you believe in the Bible is reprehensible. And I would agree. It is reprehensible. And you find plenty of atheist publications that will tell you that's reprehensible. They just don't harmonize is the point. Now, in response to those who would harmonize, or try to, who would harmonize Genesis with evolution, including some of our own brethren, as I said, a growing number of them in recent years. Mills in that book went on to say this, and you see it's on page 148 of the book. He said, if creationists now wish to abandon their historical position and acquiesce to an ancient earth, well, then I applaud their progress. But it's a farce to maintain that Genesis never really demanded a young earth, since the genealogies were always intended as metaphors. Now, you understand what he's saying here. Our brethren, some of them, are coming along and saying, the genealogies in Genesis, first 10 chapters or so, are just metaphorical. And God never really intended us to look at that and believe they were literal. Now, I want you to look at Genesis 5 for a moment and just kind of key on Genesis 5. There's an exact genealogy. All genealogies are not exact. Some of them allow for gaps. I agree with that. Matthew 1 is an example of that, and easy to see that it does. But Genesis 5 is an exact genealogy. And the reason you know it's exact is because it's different from any of the others. When you read Genesis 5, and let me just read a section of it, if you will, if you're looking at it, verse 6. The son of Adam named Seth. Seth lived 105 years and begat Enos. And notice verse 7. Now, you don't see this commonly, but you do here. And Seth lived after he begat Enos 807 years and begat sons and daughters, and all the days of Seth were 912 years and he died. Then it gives you Enos and says the exact same kind of thing for Enos and so forth down to Noah. In other words, what happens as you look at this is that a fair scrutiny of Genesis 5, for example, will demonstrate that it has to be not an about X number of thousands or millions of years, as though it were metaphorical. But when you look at Genesis 5, it's got to be an exact 1,656 years from Adam to the flood, and it cannot be any more or any less. It must be that. It just doesn't allow for the evolutionary eras or ages unless Moses is just completely inaccurate. And if he is, if the first book of the Bible is inaccurate, why believe the next 65? And that would be the point. When an atheist says you're going to try to dance around the very beginning of your Bible but demand the rest of us believe all else that it says, that's just farcical. And I say, right, it's reprehensible. Now we go further with it. Another thing that atheists find reprehensible many times is our faith. The Christians' so-called faith. Now, why do they find so reprehensible about it? Well, the Christian's own concept of faith is found to be reprehensible by skeptics because many believers misunderstand the biblical concept of faith. What does it mean to have faith? Do you have faith? What is your faith? Why do you have faith? Why do you believe what you believe? And brethren have been guilty of this misconception as well, and I would add that if you pick up the publications and so forth written by brethren, more and more and more you hear brethren having this misconception of faith. Now, I'm going to talk about what misconception I'm saying. Too many regard faith as just an emotional disposition. In other words, what is your faith? What do you believe? And then if I say to you, why do you believe it? If you start talking to me about what you feel, or if you start talking in terms about, I feel this or I feel that, too many brethren are talking in those terms way too much. And they're talking about it from everything from why they believe in God, to why they believe in the Bible, to what they believe about everything under the sun. It is no longer, I believe because. It is, I feel. Faith has become an emotional disposition rather than a logical conclusion drawn from evidence. What is the biblical concept of faith? When you look at the Bible, look at Romans 10 and verse 17. We used, and I say we, meaning members of the church, used to frequently quote Romans 10. You don't hear that much anymore. But faith comes by hearing. The older people, at least, can tell you exactly what comes next. Faith comes by hearing. Hearing by the Word or through the Word of God. When you look at passages like Jude in verse 3, Jude is saying to them that, and to paraphrase, I have told you before and continue to tell you to contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to the saints. Faith is not what you feel today. Faith is a body of evidence once delivered. When you look down in verse 20, when he tells you to grow and be established in the most holy faith, he doesn't mean what you feel in your heart. He means that which was once delivered to the saints. The faith, and Paul uses the term the faith numerous times in his writings, Paul doesn't mean what an individual Christian feels. Paul means the written, unemotional, the written word, the body of the faith. And you can look at a number of passages to check out what I'm saying there, and feel free to ask or talk to me about that. But go further with it. Modern dictionaries don't do much to help with the misconception of faith. If you look it up in the dictionaries, here's what you're going to find. Webster's, for example, probably the most accepted dictionary in America, the Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary, published in 1988, said faith is, and I quote, a firm belief in something for which there is no proof. Now, is that what your faith is? Do you have a firm, solid belief in something that has no proof? And unless you think that, that's the 80s, so maybe it's changed, the current definition from the Merriam-Webster online, 2010, is the exact same thing, word for word, verbatim. So it hadn't changed since 88. American Heritage Dictionary, published in 2000. Faith is, and they give this as their primary definition, incidentally, faith is a belief that does not rest on logical or material evidence. Now, is that your faith? No logic for it, no material evidence for it. You just feel it, and you feel it strongly. That's become the definition of faith. And atheists find that reprehensible, and so do I. That faith is an emotional disposition completely separate from logic or without basis of proof or material evidence is absolutely foreign to the biblical concept. Why would I say that? Well, when a Christian is required to have faith, there is sufficient evidence. And there's reason to have that faith. A number of passages would teach us that. God, and I'm going to look at a couple of those to close out the lesson. God never asked for this so-called blind faith that people speak of and that atheists find reprehensible. God never asked for a leap of faith. I think there was a movie back in the 80s. Boy, who in the world was that? Steve Martin that starred in that movie? I don't know why that springs to mind, but called A Leap of Faith. And I'm not sure what the movie was about, but the idea in a leap of faith or blind faith is you have no logic and no reason. You just leap. You just blindly go forth. You think you see what you're blind to, and that's faith. Now, is that what God is asking for? Believers who insist that faith is taking a blind leap provide the skeptics their ammunition, and they fire the insults. Faith in the deity of Jesus, or inspiration of the Bible, that it's really God-breathed, or the historical record of the Bible, like Genesis, all of those things have to either be established by logic and evidence, or they're worthless. In fact, it'd be just as worthless and unfounded as atheism and evolution, because they're the ones really that are blind and taking a leap of faith. And I'll be glad to tell you why I believe that. Skeptics scoff at an idea of a leap of faith. In fact, you can hear what they say. Listen to Sam Harris. He says, and I quote, "In fact, every religion preaches the truth of propositions for which no evidence is even conceivable," he says. "This is what put the leap in Kierkegaard's so-called leap of faith." If you ever wonder where that term came from, it came about 200 years ago from Søren Kierkegaard. Christopher Hutchins, who wrote this God Is Not Great book that's so popular, or has been for a while, he leveled this attack, and I quote, "Actually, the leap of faith, to give it the memorable name that Søren Kierkegaard bestowed on it, is an imposture," he says. "As he," meaning Kierkegaard himself, "pointed out, it's not a leap that can be made once and for all. It's a leap that has to go on and on." In other words, you've got to go on and on leaping, is the point. You don't just leap once. "In spite of mounting evidence to the contrary." And really what he talks about, if you read that, he describes it. And he really gives an accurate picture of so many people's faith. He says, every time a piece of evidence comes along, you got to leap over it. And when the next piece of evidence comes along, you got to leap over that. So you just got to keep on leaping. Now, is that your faith? Do you allow your faith to be challenged? Do you allow the questions to be asked? Do you ask the questions? And do you demand logic and reason to answer the questions? When we look in the Bible and we see what it actually says, here are the kind of things we find. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this, but I'll give you some passages and I get you to go home and look at these. Think about the things that God says. Isaiah 1 and verse 18. Come now and let us reason together. Or Hosea 4 and verse 6. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. That's the kind of thing God would be saying. Not take a leap of faith. Have reason. Have knowledge. The passage Tom read in Proverbs 2 or again in Proverbs 4. I've used Proverbs 4 many times over the years. And when I had a radio program, I used to use it quite a bit. Because God says, get wisdom. Get understanding. With all you're getting, you know, get knowledge. Wisdom is the principal thing. Now, that's not God saying, I want you to just blindly accept everything I say, is it? No, these passages, like Tom read in chapter 2 and again there in chapter 4, God is telling you wisdom, understanding, knowledge are what you need to base your faith upon. You come to the New Testament and you listen to passages like Acts 26 and verse 25, where Paul is defending his faith to King Agrippa II. And Paul tells him that what he believes is based on, notice, truth and reason. He didn't just blindly believe what he believed. He was saying to Agrippa, I have reason for what I believe. It is based on truth and reason. In Acts chapter 22 and verse 1, when he stood up to his fellow Jews and he made a defense, the word that's used there is apology, or the word from which we get apology. And an apology is a formal defense. When he's giving defense of his faith, or when Paul says in Philippians 1 and verse 17, I am set for the defense of the gospel. Same word is used there. In other words, I'm set to give a formal defense, a justification for the gospel. Not let me just tell you what I feel in my heart. I feel this warm, burning sensation that there is a God and the gospel is the truth. That's not why I believe the gospel. I believe the gospel because of truth and reason. I believe the gospel because of logic. I believe in the gospel because of facts that demand the conclusion that the gospel account is the only truth there is. And that's what our faith has to be. You listen to the way the New Testament continues to put it. In Luke chapter 1 and verses 1 through 4, when Luke opens up his gospel and writes to Theophilus there, and again in Acts 1, same kind of language. But when you look at that, Luke talks about writing down point by point in a logical sequence to give reason, or the word is literally proof for what Theophilus has believed and should continue to believe. And he gives evidence. Notice again in Acts 1, and I didn't put it up here, but many infallible proofs. Again, you see that in John 20, verses 30 and 31. Why is John written? To give you evidence, written eyewitness testimony that Jesus is the Son of God. Again, in 1 Peter 3 and verse 15, notice what the passage says. Be ready to give an answer. Your answer is not to be, I feel it. I'd know it in my heart if it wasn't so. Your answer is to be the reason. It's the same word that's used in Luke 1 and verse 4 as proof. When someone is coming to you and asking you what you believe, they want to know what you believe and they want to know why. And when the why, they want to know proof. Why not only you believe it because you feel it, but why they should believe it. That's what 1 Peter 3 and verse 15 is telling me. To have any other kind of faith is reprehensible. Well, there are a lot of other things, obviously, we could say. Romans 12, I guess it didn't fit on there. Romans 12, 1 and 1 Peter 2 and verse 2 both use the term logical, reasonable, logical. And 1 Peter 2 is telling us to grow in a sincere milk of the word, the King James says. But if you look at that, that phrase includes in the original, it's hard to translate, but the logical word, the reason, that's what I'm supposed to be growing in. Let me conclude by saying this. Christianity is the only logical, consistent faith in the world. I hope our study, even though it's been a little laborious on Sunday nights, I hope that what you've been seeing in all of that is that it is the only logical, consistent faith in the world, supported by evidence, reasoned by people who believe it. It's obscured, of course, by these copious beliefs like Calvinism or a leap of faith or whatever it might be, these false suppositions, and the inconsistencies. And I've really touched on that. I intend to come back next month and preach a second lesson to this, not so much this kind, but the inconsistencies in Christians that atheists find so reprehensible, and talk a little bit about it. But the inconsistencies in those who claim to practice Christianity is also, we must do everything we can as a Christian to exemplify true Christianity instead of really adding fire or ammunition to the fire and doing and saying and believing things that are so truly reprehensible.